loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In this hour, we air a special interview with Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza. We are able to speak with him at length on Sunday about the dramatic events on Saturday and the U.S.-backed coup attempt underway against his country. Later on, we'll discuss the very latest developments that took place today at the meeting of the Lima Group in Colombia.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. President Trump yesterday said that he will delay the planned increase in tariffs on Chinese goods. China and the United States have been in talks to negotiate an end to the trade war between the two countries. Tariffs were scheduled to rise this Friday from 10% to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. Britain's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said in a statement today concerning a second Brexit referendum, quote, "We are committed to putting forward or supporting an amendment in favor of a public vote to prevent a damaging Tory Brexit being forced on the country," unquote. U.S. officials said today that a U.S. airstrike in Somalia killed 35 al-Shabaab militants. Al-Shabaab is an affiliate of al-Qaeda. Airstrikes in Somalia have increased in the last few years, which analysts attribute to President Trump's easing of restrictions on when the U.S. military can strike alleged terrorists. A similar airstrike last month in Somalia killed 52 people. The Trump administration is setting up a panel of conservative scientists to dispute the existence of climate change, whether changes are from human behavior or not, and if society can make positive changes to mitigate the warming climate. Three senior administration officials say the goal of the group is to, quote, counter conclusions that the continued burning of fossil fuels is harming the planet, unquote. That's according to the Washington Post. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Today on Loud and Clear, we are very excited to present an extensive interview with Venezuela's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Jorge Arreaza. In addition to his current role as the country's top diplomat, which he has held since 2017, Minister Arreaza previously served in the cabinet as the minister in charge of education, science, and technology, and was Venezuela's vice president from 2013 to 2016. We traveled to New York on Sunday to conduct the interview at Venezuela's diplomatic residence in the city. Minister Arreaza, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with the events of yesterday. It was a very dramatic day. There were clashes and provocations along the Venezuela-Colombia border, as well as the Venezuela-Brazil border. There were also large demonstrations in support of the government of Nicolas Maduro. The United States, the opposition, they say that this was all about humanitarian aid. But how do you assess the events of February 23rd?
Yeah, yesterday, there was a lot of pressure, no? Especially from abroad, international pressure. This is an intervention. It's a coup d'etat that has been attempted against the Venezuelan institutions. And it has been essentially done from Washington, from the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon, and from Colombia. Now, it's a shame, our neighboring country, people who we love, but it's a government that is absolutely subordinated to Washington, and they use Colombian territory to do what they have done in the past. Now, this has happened before, not only in Latin America, places like Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, but in other places where with a disguise of humanitarian aid, what you try to do is to break down the sovereignty of Venezuela in this case. You are calling the military to rebel against their own government and to break their law and the constitution. And this is all a show. This is a spectacle. This is for the media, for the mainstream media. That's why you saw yesterday so many medias and journalists in the bridge between Venezuela and Colombia. But this is, of course, no one who's really coherent and not insane would really believe that President Trump or President Duque are concerned about the Venezuelan humble and poor and cannot sleep because the Venezuelans are suffering. That's not Trump. No, the man of the war, the man of the loots when they intervene. So what we really have here is part, it's another phase of the coup, and it's one of the options. You know, President Trump says that all the options are on the table. Well, this was one of the options. And they are looking forward for another kind of intervention, not discarding a military intervention.
Both the United Nations and the Red Cross refused to participate in what we saw yesterday, the delivery of this so-called humanitarian aid. Why is that?
Because it's not humanitarian aid. Because food and medicine there, we don't even know what was in those boxes. And it's not neutral. It's politicized. It has political objectives. It doesn't have humanitarian objectives. So, of course, that the UN could not participate, and of course, even less the Red Cross, because the objective was to open a channel and to, you know, this happened in Dominican Republic in 1965. The government of the U.S. declared a humanitarian crisis in Dominican Republic. They went to the OAS, the Organization of American States, where they had control of all the governments. And they decided that they were going to send humanitarian aid to Dominican Republic. There was a very important president, left president in Dominican Republic, Juan Bosch. They didn't like him. There was no humanitarian crisis in Dominican Republic. So they sent some doctors, some nurses, some boxes of medicine and food, and 8,000 Marines came along. They overthrew the president Bosch, and they installed a dictatorship that lasted for several decades. So that's what they are trying to do in Venezuela. And of course, the government of Venezuela has the obligation, constitutional obligation, to stop this from happening.
There were several deaths yesterday, many injured. The media in the United States, the Trump administration, the opposition, they say that this was because of repressive actions by the government and the security forces. How do you respond to those charges?
In the Colombian border, there were no deaths at all. That's all fake news. Something happened in the Brazilian Venezuelan border. We will have to wait some days to prove that if actually those people died in the border, most of them were killed by bullets that are not used by the armed forces in Venezuela. But it's you know, everything that happens in Venezuela is maximized and is shown as Maduro's and the government's fault. But it's a matter of time that we can prove how things happened yesterday.
Of course, and we should remember, for instance, the war in Iraq started with a lie about weapons of mass destruction. The war in Vietnam began with a lie about the Gulf of Tonkin. Yeah. You know, speaking about humanitarian aid, I think some important context here is the assistance that Venezuela has actually supported or given to the people of the United States. You know, the heating oil, the assistance during Hurricane Katrina. Could you elaborate on some of those activities?
Yes, always. You know, we have a company here, CITGO, which has been stolen from us by this government. And it's really a theft because that's from the Venezuelan state. So they confiscated it like in a communist government, and they blocked our money. So, but we, using this company, we used to give humanitarian aid every single time that there were catastrophes, natural catastrophes in the south of the U.S., in Puerto Rico. As well, we sent $5 million to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, and we also had a program for the poor in the Bronx here in New York and other places of the U.S. so that they could have their heating oil, they could afford the heating oil during the winter. And it's always been like this. Whenever there is a situation in the Caribbean, the first country that is there to help is Venezuela. When there was the hurricanes in 2017. In Antigua and Barbuda, we managed to land in Barbuda, you know, with a military aircraft, Venezuelan military aircraft, and we moved all the population of that island to the other island in between hurricanes. And that is the spirit of the Bolivarian Revolution. It's solidarity that is always in the center.
Like you mentioned, the United States has been calling on the armed forces to rebel against the elected president, President Maduro. There were some defections yesterday, but they were generally low level. How do you assess the performance of the security forces so far during this crisis?
Our armed forces have more than 200,000 professionals and troops. And during all this coup, in which the CIA has been acting and has been calling our military of all the ranks, I believe it's what 20, 30 militaries that have defected, and none of them important, none of the high commands. So, and they, I mean, they're doing this even with the military attaches, of Venezuela, in Brazil, in Washington. And in Brazil, the military attaché, the American, invited ours. Of course, he told us he had the permission. And when he was in the meeting, a fellow from the CIA appeared. He said, "I am Mr. Tal. I work for the CIA, and we offer you money. We offer you whatever you want, but you have to rebel against Maduro." So, and when our military responded, outraged, then the man told him, "You have to understand me. I'm doing my job, and we're doing this all over with all the Venezuelans at the chess." So it's imperialism happening, really.
I want to turn now to some historical context. Of course, the mainstream media's presentation of the situation in Venezuela has been completely devoid of historical context. So, first of all, what is the Bolivarian Revolution? Why did the Venezuelan people make this revolution? What are its goals?
First of all, my country was almost a colony of the United States before the Bolivarian Revolution. We were not an independent state at all, not in the political sphere and not in the economic sphere and in none. So we became really, continued Simón Bolívar's struggle and project with Comandante Chávez. And of course, that meant that we had control of our own natural resources, especially oil. And that profit, that the rent from the oil was distributed amongst the poor. And so we democratized access to education, which was going to be privatized. We democratized access to housing, to everything. So it's a democratic process in which more and more have access to their own social rights. That is the Bolivarian Revolution. And that is why we have such a support in spite of all the economic difficulties and all the international aggressions.
Let's talk a little bit more about democracy in Venezuela. How does it work, both in the formal electoral sense and also the grassroots institutions, the participatory institutions?
In the formal sense, we have a very democratic constitution. We have to elect our president, our national assembly, our mayors, our governors. And then we have a very democratic, popular organization, which is the community councils and the communes, las comunas. And there are elections and democratic processes in Venezuela, not every 5 years or 4 years, but every single day. And of course, it's a new way of doing democracy. And that is also one of the things that the government of the United States doesn't like. Because if you can build a new model of democracy so close to the United States, you are threatening the model of capitalistic democracy that you have here in the States.
And this, of course, isn't the first time that the United States attempted to carry out a regime change operation in Venezuela. Tell us about the events in April 2002.
It's been happening. If here in the U.S. There's such a concern because they say that the Russians were intervened during the electorate campaign. Well, we have the intervention of the U.S. government every single day, every single hour, every single minute since 2001, at least 2001. And they have been behind all the coups, all the sabotage, the forcing referendums, everything that has happened, all the terrorist attacks in the streets, the political violence in 2007, in 2014, in 2017, this has been funded and backed by the U.S. government. And in spite of that, what we're looking for is for dialogue with the U.S. government. We understand that the real boss here of the opposition in Venezuela is not this member of parliament, Guaido. It is Mr. Trump. So the best thing that could happen is that we could get to gather at a high level, maybe our presidents, and then we could solve many things. Because we know that the ones taking the decision in the case of the opposition, it's not happening in Venezuela, it's happening in Washington. So let's go to the place that we have to go.
That's an important point because, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's very advanced stages of negotiations going on in the Dominican Republic in 2017. I mean, it appeared that there was an agreement forged there, but what happened?
There was an agreement. And the only thing pending the day before was the date of the presidential elections, which by our constitution had to be held last year, the last day of the mandate. And finally, we agreed with the date that the opposition suggested. And what happened the next day when everything was set? This was a very integral agreement. One of the things that would have happened if it would have been signed is that we would come together, opposition, government, and the mediators to Washington and ask and demand the U.S. government to lift the sanctions against Venezuela. So what happened is everything was ready. The president of the Dominican Republic was there. Former president of Spain, Zapatero, was there. Some ministers of foreign affairs that helped. And the cameras were there. The lights were on. The agreements were already printed. And when the delegation of the opposition arrived, they said they wouldn't sign. And why? Well, it seems very obvious. In Bogota, President Santos, former president, and former Secretary of State Tillerson were meeting, and they called the opposition and they said, you don't dare to sign anything with Maduro because we want this man out. We want a regime change. We don't want elections in Venezuela.
I just want to go back to the 2002 coup attempt one last time, because I think it's so important. Could you talk a little bit more about the role of media manipulation and how that was integral?
That coup was essentially mediatic. Because what they did was to, even there were videos of the militaries that rebelled against Comandante Chavez that were recorded in the morning saying that they condemned the deaths that had happened this afternoon in Caracas, hours before any people were died. And we know that snipers were paid by the opposition, by the U.S. We don't really know which of both paid them. And that's why there were deaths. So this was a coup made for the media. And then they had these images where Chavistas were defending the presidential palace. And it was crossfire, but with the police that was in the coup. And they said that these Chavistas were firing the peaceful demonstration from the opposition are killing civilians. There was no demonstration around, but because of the angle of the TV scene, so they believed that this man was saying in TV was real, and that's why many other militaries joined. So it was done by the media. It was done by the CIA, and it worked for 47 hours. Because the people of Venezuela, the poor in Venezuela, never believed on that version of the media. They never believed that Comandante Chavez had resigned, and they went to the streets to look for their president. And 47 hours later, he was president again.
Let's turn to the economy now. First of all, what are the effects that the U.S. sanctions are having on the economy of Venezuela?
It's very grave. It's because the main effect is that it's so difficult to import, to buy whatever we need, medicine, food, raw material, parts and pieces for machinery, for the industry, everything, because the banking system, which depends from New York and London, doesn't want to work with Venezuela. Not only, it's not that they don't want to, it's because they are afraid of the sanctions. There is an overcompliance of the sanctions. So a transaction that should happen in 48 hours can take 48 days, or it can never happen. No, so that's why we're working with the UN, so that the UN can purchase, and then we will pay for that in Venezuelan territory with dollars, with euros, with whatever, because we have. The thing is that the banking system and all these providers of services, shipments and everything, they don't want to work with Venezuela. And we have to pay at the moment the insurance prime that we are paying is a war insurance prime. That is a lot of money. And this makes things and products much more expensive if we get to really import them finally. So it's really damaging and making things difficult. But we have built new routes with Russia, with China, with Turkey, with India. And we will, this doesn't happen from one day to the other. But we are learning how to avoid and how to bypass this blockade.
And overall, what is the situation like for ordinary Venezuelans? I mean, I've heard a lot of people saying, well, there's an economic crisis, but there's not a humanitarian crisis. Could you elaborate on that?
We have, in 2016, 2017, we had obvious shortages of some products. You know? Situation now is much better. And the main issue is inflation. It's the prices. In spite of that, these two first months of 2019, we have seen for the first time, at least in 2 years, that the prices have some of them have stopped increasing and some of them have even decreased. So this is good news. The exchange rate also has this parallel, this illegal, the black market, however you want to call it, has also stopped increasing. So that's good news because this is translated into the prices immediately. And these rates in the past, the exchange rate from the euro with the bolivar or the dollar was not set by the central bank in Venezuela or by the finance minister. It was set by web pages in Miami. This was all a laboratory operation against the Venezuelan currency. And it had very good effects for our enemies, but very bad effects for our people.
What are some of the measures that the government of Venezuela is taking to alleviate the effects of the economic situation?
Well, some of them are already working, like this one. We have, with the private sector, we found a strategy to balance the exchange rate and to stop it from increasing. But other measures, of course, we have all the subsidizes and all the social policies that the Bolivarian Revolution has, but we have continued. We have not sacrificed one Bolivar, $1 from the social investment in Venezuela. More new housing, houses for the people, more schools, and of course, free education, free health system. And that we are struggling, but we are making it happen. And we have to diversify our economy because we cannot depend on oil forever. And it's happening. No, it's not easy with the sanctions and with the blockade, but it's beginning to happen. And we will see a new economy raising in Venezuela in the next 5 years.
There are two programs in particular that I'm interested in hearing more about, the CLAPS and also the Card of the Fatherland. Can you tell us what those are and how they've been functioning?
Yes, they are related to each other. No? The CLAPS is a system of distribution of food, at least the essential products for a family. And they knock your door and they sell it to you at a very low price. Subsidized, absolutely subsidized. Why? Because this economic warfare against Venezuela as I told you, in 2016 and 2017, you had to make lines for hours and hours in order to get a kilogram of rice. But it's not happening now. But we have also this complementary system of food distribution which is the CLAPS. And why is it working? Because it's not the private sectors or companies that distribute. It's the people. Organized people, the community councils that make this happen with their neighbors, whomever. This is for everyone. No? You can be a Chavista or not Chavista. This is for all the people, and it's working. And the card of the homeland, el carnet de la patria, it's a very important social policy because now we have technology. We really know who needs and what they need. No? Maybe you need a subsidized of for something for your income, but another family needs something else, and you need a house, but the other family doesn't need a house, or the other family already had a house from the policies in Venezuela. So now we have organized all the data in Venezuela, and it's working very well.
And can you tell us a little bit more about what the Bolivarian missions are and how they've been able to function given the current economic environment?
The Bolivarian missions, they began in 2003 when we finally got control of our oil industry, of PDVSA. And it meant that the oil profit, the oil rent, oil income was, for the first time in the Venezuelan history, distributed not amongst the rich and abroad, but amongst the poor. And how? Well, teaching those who didn't know how to write or read, you know, the illiterate, to read and write. or making social policies for those who didn't have the opportunities to study in the primary schools or secondary high schools and universities even. It was about building houses for the poor. It was about subsidizes and food for the poor as well. So we were investing, and of course, health. There are doctors all over the Venezuelan and geography. You can walk a couple of blocks from your house. There's a doctor that can visit you at 3 a.m. if you have a problem, health problem. So this happened because the oil income was invested in social policies. And it was really effective. It is still very effective today in spite of the blockade. And that is why we have such a support.
We're conducting this interview in New York City. Rent has been skyrocketing in this city. And last year, 1 in 10 children in the New York City public school system were homeless. That's over 100,000 young people. Now in Venezuela, and I think you alluded to this, there's dramatic efforts being taken by the government to guarantee housing for all people. Can you tell us a little bit more about the housing mission?
Yes, we did. In 2011, Comandante Chavez launched this mission, no, for this Gran Misión Vivienda Venezuela, Housing Venezuela. And we make the people's register to tell us what they needed, no, if they needed a house or if they needed to improve the house that they already had. And now with the Homeland Card, it's even easier. And what has happened is that we have delivered 2,500,000 houses to the people. But these are not, I mean, small houses of one room. This is three-room houses or apartments with two or three bathrooms, toilets, and new buildings. And this has been built for the poor, for the people. And when you say 2,500,000, that's at least four or five members in per family. So we're talking of millions of Venezuelans that are living much better off today than they were in the past.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I want to turn now to the international situation. Of course, you're the top diplomat in the Venezuelan government, and you've been here in New York working to assemble a coalition of countries that reject U.S.-led intervention in Venezuela. How have those efforts been going? Have they been successful?
They have been very successful. And it's very important you use the word coalition. Usually coalitions are for war. Usually coalitions are meant to break international law and invade and destroy countries and peoples. This kind of coalition we are building is for peace, is for the defense and respect of international law, of the principles of the UN Charter. And it is not for Venezuela or to defend President Maduro. It is to defend whichever country is threatened by the powerful with military use of force. So we are very satisfied. This was not a Venezuelan initiative. This was an initiative from friends from the world. And we began with 15 countries. And the last meeting we had last week, 60 delegations were there. And it's and as they have said in the debates, if we don't stop this against Venezuela, who's going to be next? So this has to be stopped, and peace has to be the only mean with the international law.
Let's talk about some of the other international groupings that have been formed since this crisis began, since the self-proclamation of Juan Guaido as the president. Out of a conference in Uruguay, it appears that the two groupings have come out. There's the International Contact Group and then another initiative led by Uruguay and Mexico. How have those been shaping up? What effect have they been having?
Yes, two mechanisms were created. The mechanism of Montevideo, which was organized by Uruguay, Mexico, and the countries of the Caribbean, the CARICOM community. And the objective of this mechanism is to make the parties in Venezuela sit down, have a dialogue process, and build their own solution to this institutional kind of crisis. The other one is the International Group of Contact, which was suggested or created by the European Union. And Uruguay has joined as a bridge over all both mechanisms. And there are other Latin American countries. But this one is different because it's suggesting or imposing the solution that the Europeans believe is the only one, which is doing again, repeating the presidential elections, which happened last year. So they want for the Venezuelan government to violate its own constitution in order to do what they want. But in spite of that, we have spoke to them. A delegation from Europe and Uruguay visited Caracas last week, and we had a very long meeting with them. Then we met also with the vice president and them. And we're trying to make them understand that if they want to help, they have to make pressure to the opposition to sit down, because we are already sitting down in the dialogue table, so that they sit down, they discard all these military options that they are also supporting against their own people, against their own families, and they cannot impose any kind of election or of solution. This has to be built amongst the Venezuelans.
Now let's talk about the Lima group. There's a coalition of countries that is supporting the U.S. agenda. Many of them are newly elected right-wing governments. Tell us about the Lima group. Has there been any engagement there, or is it simply an instrument of aggression?
You know that the name Lima, it's offensive to the Peruvian people, which is a Bolivarian people. It was one of the countries that Bolivar helped to liberate, to free. And it's really a Washington group. No? And tomorrow, Monday, everything is going to be very frank and sincere, because for the first time, the U.S. is going to be part of this meeting, of this group, and not represented by any delegate. It's going to be Vice President Pence, who's going to be in Bogota there, dictating the orders to the other governments, which are subordinated to the U.S. government, and they are doing what the U.S. are telling them to do, which is sad that these Latin American countries cannot take decisions by themselves and have to follow all the orders given by the U.S. government. But that is what it has happened before in the Latin American history. The U.S. has had in the past opportunities to control almost all the governments. But now they have Venezuela, they have Cuba, they have Bolivia, they have Nicaragua, they have the countries of the Caribbean, they have Mexico, they have Uruguay. So it's not the same scenario, but they are trying to impose, to isolate Venezuela with this group. And it's a failure. It's not going to happen.
Following that thread about the Lima Group summit that will be taking place on Monday in Colombia that Mike Pence himself will attend, are you concerned that they may push for the so-called military option there? Will there be a dramatic escalation of that nature?
I'm not sure, because some of these governments, Latin American governments, have said that they agree with everything that the United States proposed, but not with a military intervention. But at the same time, nevertheless, they are helping to create the conditions for a military operation. So it's kind of a contradiction. But I believe that if there were to be any kind of military operation against Venezuela, that's going to be decided in Washington, in the Pentagon, and not even the U.S. Congress is going to be consulted about it.
I want to read a couple of recent statements. So Guaido yesterday, he tweeted this: "The events of today oblige me to take a decision, to formally propose to the international community that we should keep all options open to achieve the liberation of our homeland." Now, Marco Rubio replied to that tweet, and he said, "The grave crimes committed today by the Maduro regime have opened the door to various potential multilateral actions not on the table just 24 hours ago." Are they talking about a war?
Yes, and probably that tweet, Guaido's tweet, was not written by him. It's probably done by Marco Rubio, which is his immediate boss in the chain of command. No, and this group, what they want is a war. What they want is an invasion. And that's not what the Venezuelan people want, and not what the Latin American wants, and not what the American from North American people want. So this has to be stopped. And I am sure that even here in the United States, in spite of all this demonization of the Bolivarian Revolution and President Maduro, I am sure that most of the people of the United States are against war, because not only Venezuelans would die if they use Colombia as a way to attack Venezuela. Colombians would die. If they do a direct intervention with Marines, the Americans would also die, because we know how to resist. We know how to make a war also Maybe Vietnam could be compared to what we are able of doing. We don't want that for Venezuela. We don't want that for our region. But if it were to happen, we would respond and we would resist. So it's very important what the people here in the United States, and we are not saying that they have to defend socialism or the Bolivarian Revolution or President Maduro. We're saying that they have to defend the right of the peoples to peace. They have to defend the Charter of the United Nations, and they have to defend the principle that war should not happen amongst the countries of this world.
And of course, during the Vietnam War in the United States, there were enormous demonstrations, some of the largest demonstrations who have ever taken place in this country. Yesterday, on February 23rd, there were actions in cities all across the United States, all around the world. On March 16th, in front of the White House, there's going to be a national demonstration organized by the Answer Coalition against the coup, against the sanctions, and against war. What effect do these solidarity actions have on the situation in Venezuela? How are they received?
We know that most of the American people, if they knew the truth, if they really knew what has happened, we are not a perfect government, no? We are human beings. We probably have committed many mistakes as any other government. We have a lot of problems in Venezuela as any other government has problems. Some things in Venezuela are solved and in other countries they are not. Some things in other countries are solved and not in Venezuela. But I am sure that if all the American people knew the truth, they would never support any kind of war or intervention in Venezuela. And they would demonstrate all over. But it's the media has been acting for at least 15 years, saying that Chavez was a dictator, saying that Maduro is a dictator and that there's torture in Venezuela and that we repress everyone, which is not true. No, and what it is about, I mean, I insist, you don't have to love the Venezuelan Revolution. You don't have to love President Maduro. You have to love peace. And you have to stop Trump from making a war in Venezuela.
Now, in Venezuela and in the United States, there are, of course, these demonstrations taking place. The U.S. media has completely blacked out, I would say, the mobilizations taking place in favor of the Bolivarian Revolution, in favor of President Maduro, and, as you say, simply in opposition to U.S. intervention in the country. I mean, what effect do you think that has? I mean, it's clearly part of a strategy. It's obviously deliberate. Why are they doing that?
They have always done that. We are invisible. The real revolution is invisible for the media. So what the only thing they show is their version of the things that we do wrong, no? Or we are supposed to be doing wrong. So, there are times when the peoples of every nation can understand that they are being used and they are trying to alienate you through the media, and the people are looking for the truth. And they are using social networks, social media, in order to get information, real information about Venezuela. So what they have to do is try really to get to the truth and not to listen to what the news is saying on TV or on the radio or whatever, or in the newspaper. You know that the American people are the first victims of imperialism. It's not Palestine or Venezuela or Cuba or Iraq. It's the American people, the working class in America. And I am sure that the humble in America will do what they have to do in order to know what is the truth and to stop their own government from going to war.
Mr. Arieza, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, my honor.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, filling in for Brian Becker.
Now we want to follow up on the latest developments in Venezuela. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, our producer and a Sputnik News analyst. He conducted the interview that you just heard. Following the dramatic events of last Saturday, where supporters of coup leader Juan Guaido attempted to storm the Venezuelan-Colombian border, the so-called Lima group of countries supporting Guaido held a high-profile meeting in Colombia where Mike Pence gave an address. Walter, the Lima Group is well known as an opponent of President Maduro, and the Lima Group countries lined up immediately after the coup that has attempted to install Juan Guaido as president of Venezuela to endorse Guaido. So why should we pay any attention to what the Lima Group has to say today?
The Lima Group is an essential tool for the U.S. regime change operation in Venezuela, because of the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America, where in many, many, many different instances, I mean, we can just think about in the past 50 years or so, there were invasions, there were dictatorships installed. So, you know, in the southern cone of Latin America, of South America, so-called, in Argentina, there is a dictatorship installed in the 1970s as part of something called Operation Condor, which was the sort of continent-wide push against socialist and communist insurgent groups. So, you know, there's a dictatorship installed in Argentina. There's the 1973 coup in Chile that installed the Pinochet regime. There are dictatorships installed in Uruguay and in Paraguay. From 1964 until the 1980s, there is a U.S.-backed military dictatorship. In Brazil in 1965, the U.S. invaded the Dominican Republic, and we could just go on and on and on all day listing all of these other interventions. So there had to be, for it to be politically palatable, right, for this effort to overthrow President Maduro and install Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, or a opposition leader who was actually not very well known up until the time when he decided that he was the president and Mike Pence agreed. They had to have sort of this grouping of regional countries to give it legitimacy, to make it seem like it was something that was coming from the region and not exclusively being imposed from Washington, which is, of course, the reality of what's going on. I mean, if you just look at the sequence, the timing of how all of the, you know, the proclamation of Guaido as the president, the video message delivered to Venezuela, the quote unquote, the Venezuelan people by Mike Pence the day prior, the sanctions that were obviously all ready to be rolled out, the international campaign, it's all conducted by Washington, but they need this thing called the Lima Group, composed of, I mean, unfortunately, like maybe half of the countries in Latin America, including a lot of the biggest ones like Brazil and Argentina, that are governed by right-wing political parties and presidents, to endorse this strategy and to add to the diplomatic isolation of the Venezuelan government. So this meeting in Colombia, highly anticipated today. I think the reason why they held it today on Monday and not on Sunday, the day after the February 23rd clashes, is that they were hoping that, you know, give it 24 hours, maybe we'll get a general or some other significant military leader to defect. That didn't happen. So now they're all gathering to plot their next moves. But I think that things are not going according to plan for the Lima Group, for Guaido, for the Trump administration.
Vice President Pence said some really threatening remarks today at the Lima Group meeting. One of the comments is something we've actually heard from the administration already, that, quote, all options are on the table.
I hate when they say that.
What does that mean? Is that a code for Venezuelan leaders? Are they supposed to feel threatened by that? Or is that just a foreshadowing of military action to come, or both? What does that mean exactly?
It's definitely a threat. It's absolutely a threat. All options being on the table. Well, okay, so let's see. What are the options that the United States has to pressure the government of Venezuela? Well, there are sanctions,
well,
right?
They've done that.
Yeah, already done that. They could try to isolate the country diplomatically. Already done
that too.
Yeah, right. They could, you know, denounce them publicly. They could, there's a number of options that they're already pursuing. What's the one thing that they haven't pursued yet? Well, that would be a military strike of some sort. They've already tried to assassinate President Maduro, by the way, too. You know, in August, we shouldn't forget, you know, there's so much going on. It's easy to forget different developments. But in August, there was a swarm of explosive drones that flew towards President Maduro while he was giving a speech to members of the armed forces. And luckily, the snipers and his security detail were able to shoot them or otherwise disable the drones. But, all of these different measures have been taken. The one thing left to do is an overt military intervention, whether that's involves, quote unquote, boots on the ground, right, involves the deployment of large numbers of U.S. ground troops. That, you know, is something to be debated, and I'm sure is being debated right now inside the Trump administration, inside the Pentagon. But that's what they mean. It's a clear threat meant to escalate the psychological pressure on the government, right? So, you know, I think they talk about all options being on the table, both with regard to Venezuela and to other targeted countries by the United States, you know, as a psychological measure, as well as, you know, a sincere declaration of intent, you know, to sort of amp up the pressure on especially military leaders, right, to defect. But that has not happened. I mean, there's been very low level defections and not a lot of them. The Venezuelan military is absolutely standing strong in the face of all of this. So I think those are the goals. But I am really concerned that this isn't just a psychological maneuver, that this might actually reflect some type of operational planning going on within the Trump administration to take this next step in the escalation ladder.
The chairman of the relevant committee in Congress, in U.S. Congress, has said that not all options are on the table, has said that, well, military action is not something that we will consider. But theoretically, that's supposed to be under Congress to decide that. But we haven't necessarily seen that over the past couple of even decades now. It's not necessarily Congress always making the call on that. How do you see that? Is that comment is actually making a difference in this scenario?
I think it is politically important in one sense that, you know, it reflects divided opinion within the U.S. political and military elites, right? That there's sort of a wing that says, like, okay, well, we definitely want to carry out regime change. We definitely want to economically strangle this country. But it would just be too, it's just too wild of an idea to actually have an invasion of this country that, you know, has a relatively advanced military, has many, many, many people, our regular armed forces, as well as, you know, citizen volunteers prepared to defend their homeland. It's just too wild of an idea. It can't possibly work. And so I think that's a positive sign for people who are hoping to build, you know, a mass movement against the sanctions and the coup and the plans for a war. On the other hand, the executive branch has effectively asserted the right to wage war, right? Which is explicitly against what the Constitution designates, right? You know, Congress has the power to declare war under the Constitution. But, you know, if you call it something other than a war, the legal precedent has been established that you can basically do whatever you want.
At the Lima Group meeting today, like I mentioned, were a ton of really threatening comments from a lot of different people. Colombia's President Ivan Duque, one of the most, you know, right-wing leaders in that region, or maybe worldwide, called on regional allies to create a, quote, more powerful and effective, unquote, ring around Maduro. I mean, that essentially sounds like the Lima Group to me, but maybe amped up. What do you think that might look like?
I'm not sure. And I'm not even sure that he knows exactly what he's talking about there, too, because the coup plan is really not going well for them. And it seems like it was only half thought out to begin with. You know, there are some reports that, like, people in the administration thought that Maduro would be gone within, like, 24 or 48 hours after Juan Guaido proclaimed himself the president and was recognized as such by the Trump administration, who obviously had the idea in the first place. So that clearly hasn't happened. In fact, what we've seen is, if anything, a surge of support for the government. I mean, if attendance at the rallies that are both, you know, in favor of President Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution and simply in opposition to military intervention in defense of their country's sovereignty, if that's any indication, then support for the government is actually growing as a consequence of this. And so they're coming out with sort of vague statements like that, which sound threatening, right? Which sort of amp up the pressure or continue the atmosphere of pressure on the government, but don't actually have any specific content, because I think what they're grasping for what to do next, because really the next logical thing would be a military intervention, if, you know, because all of these other less dramatic actions have failed. But I think they know that they couldn't win such a war, that the Venezuelan people are definitely going to fight. It wouldn't be like, you know, usually when the U.S. invades a country, it's after the fighting capacity has been degraded so tremendously over a very long period of time. Like Iraq is sort of the classic example of this. After you had, you know, suffocated it, sanctioned it, the military was sort of already coming apart, then they sort of go in and finish the job. That's not at all what the situation in Venezuela is.
Just a quick follow-up. We've seen footage on the ground. I think PBS NewsHour did a really important video piece this weekend, or maybe late last week, talking to some of the citizen militia members, the volunteer militia, people who were either extremely strong Maduro supporters or just supporters of the revolution who broadly would fight for their right to kind of have sovereignty within Venezuela, even if they had qualms with the current government. And they were ready. They were absolutely ready to fight. And that's, like you said, 2 million people. I mean, that's a really big force to reckon with.
And, you know, like we just heard Foreign Minister Arieza saying that the first victims of U.S. imperialism in a certain sense are the people of the United States, because it's not going to be the sons and daughters of Donald Trump or Elliot Abrams or Mike Pence who go and fight, or, you know, the sons and daughters of, you know, the executives at ExxonMobil that hope to loot Venezuela's natural resources. They're not going to be the ones who are doing the fighting. It's going to be, you know, poor and working class people, people who don't have other options for the most part, who are sent to fight and die and kill. And so, you know, the Venezuelan people have made it very, very clear through a number of different armed forces. So there's, you know, there's the regular armed forces, the FANB, the Bolivarian National Armed Forces. There's the Bolivarian National Guard. There's the Bolivarian National Police. And the numerically largest armed force is the Bolivarian National Militia, which involves upwards of 2 million people who are receiving training right now. So it would be an unbelievably devastating conflict if the United States chose to do this. And it's something that should be of concern, I think, to all people around the world.
Let's talk about policy for a second, too. I mean the United States government has gone out on a limb to talk with great bluster. Does that mean that there's no wiggle room to back off? Because otherwise, it looks like Maduro's support is holding strong, and the only alternative then is bloodshed.
That's the huge danger, I think, because, you know, if we can think of other situations where the United States really invested a lot in achieving a particular foreign policy goal, like really put their credibility on the line, at a certain point, it seems like there's a tendency among the people who run the United States to decide to double down on it, to intensify their commitment to it, even if that commitment actually deepens the crisis that they find themselves in. So, for instance, in Vietnam, right? Right. So, you know, the United States was obviously being militarily defeated in Vietnam. And what did the Nixon administration do? Well, they bombed Cambodia. They bombed Laos. They expanded the war. They decided to go, Vietnam's just one country, right? Why not go to war with three countries in Southeast Asia? In Iraq, too, I mean, people might not remember this. And of course, it didn't come to fruition. But there's like a real push to go to war with Iran on the pretext that the resistance groups in Iraq that were fighting U.S. soldiers were getting their arms and supplies from Iran, which I don't know, may or may not be true. But, you know, it was the same basic impulse, right? So, okay, we're defeated here. We're losing here. Why don't we go to war with another country at the same time? Because, you know, the worst thing for the United States when they're, you know, and the military and foreign policy planners are thinking in global terms, you know, we're the global hegemon. If we put our credibility on the line, if we say a certain leader must go, then they must go, or else our ability to pull off similar maneuvers, our ability to manage our global empire is imperiled. And so, yeah, I'm really concerned that that kind of logic might kick in, and something that seems completely ridiculous, unthinkable, you know, a U.S. attack on a military attack on Venezuela could actually happen.
You know, John Bolton has already made clear months ago, I think, what his troika of tyranny is, right? He named Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. So, like, there are two other countries right there that he could potentially try to force people to, or force our armed forces to expand into. But there's got to be a way to diplomatically, like, let this calm down and come down. So, if Guaido was to pull back, there's got to be somebody in that country, maybe Maduro himself, who would be able to kind of talk to the U.S. And there's got to be some way to come down off that ladder of escalation. Do you see any way that that could happen at some point?
Well, I thought it was interesting what Mr. Arieza said, basically that, you know, we tried talking to the opposition. That was a waste of time because we actually reached a deal right in the Dominican Republic in 2017. And then they just sort of backed out at the last moment when Rex Tillerson basically told them to. So it's kind of, you know, like, we'll talk to them, but it's really a waste of our time. We should talk to their actual boss. We should talk to the people who are actually in charge, right? Which is the Trump administration, the puppet master is pulling the strings. So I think that would be a big step forward, right? If the Trump administration was kind of like forced to the bargaining table by the steadfastness of the Venezuelan government. There are a couple other international initiatives too that could lend itself to a resolution of the crisis in a way that sort of in which Venezuela retains its independence. There's the mechanism of Montevideo. Montevideo is the capital of Uruguay. There is a conference in Uruguay in early February, like a week or two after the crisis really kicked off. And there are two international institutions that came out of that conference. Basically, the conference split. It was countries were invited that were like not in the Lima group, not 100% on board with the regime change push. One of the institutions that came out of that, or one of the groupings that came out of that, is the International Contact Group, So, you know, like we just heard of, that's sort of the European countries' initiative. And how I would interpret their orientation is they're the countries who do want there to be regime change, right? But they just think that war is an outrageous idea and something that would like completely backfire. So kind of like some of the Democrats who are saying like, oh, well, you know, Maduro is a horrible dictator, XYZ, we should definitely economically strangle our country, but hey, let's not take the step of bombing them. That's the international contact group. And then there's the Montevideo mechanism, which I think has a much more reasonable approach. So that's Mexico, Uruguay, the Caribbean community, which groups most of the countries of the Caribbean together. And so they're basically saying, we'll do whatever we need to mediate an internal dialogue in Venezuela so that there can be a Venezuelan solution to a Venezuelan crisis, right? So it sort of has as its baseline the sovereignty and self-determination of the country.
So those are some of the bigger, broader diplomatic potential options for trying to de-escalate this. Within the U.S., though, because the U.S. is really the primary threat and the primary aggressor in this situation, it seems like our biggest option is standing up as people, as citizens, and saying this is not something that any of us want. We don't want another war. We don't believe that the U.S. should be trampling on another country's sovereignty. And so I guess my question is, you know, we've seen so many extremely right-wing politicians and leaders of other countries come on board with this, right? Like Ivan Duque of Colombia, incredibly right-wing, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, somebody that was talked about in mainstream press up to the election, up, you know, before his election recently, as, you know, this like Trump in Brazil. And then Trump himself is on board with this. He's the one spearheading this. We've even most recently seen Marco Rubio tweet a picture of a bloodied, wounded former Libyan president, Muammar Gaddafi, before he was sodomized and hung in Libya. By the way, the Washington Post wrote a piece about that and called the message to Maduro awkward. This was an awkward tweet, not a, you know, violent or awful or threatening tweet. Anyway, we've seen all these right-wing, super conservative people and politicians come onto the side of this coup attempt in Venezuela. You know, I think at some point, and we're maybe already seeing the public start to stand up to this, can you tell us kind of what might be happening and whether that's going to really try to, whether the public's really going to start to stand up, you know, based on this ridiculous and wild coup attempt that's happening in Venezuela? Yeah, I know there were actions this weekend. Can you just tell us what happened?
Those are all very important things to note. And I would add to your list of extreme right-wing politicians. So today, when Mike Pence was speaking in Colombia at the Summit of the Lima Group, he gave sort of a special shout out to Hamilton Mourão, who is the vice president of Brazil, who is a general, who is Jair Bolsonaro, also a former military officer's, running mate, now vice president. His ascension to the top levels of Brazilian politics was basically a very clear signal that we're going back to the days of the 1964, to 80s military dictatorship. So, I mean, this is like a really sinister figure who was given like a special thank you from Mike Pence from the podium for being so hospitable to the people of Venezuela who, you know, are, streaming across the border into Brazil, or, you know, for helping to provide quote unquote humanitarian support to them. So, I think what this is really shaping up to be is a hemispheric offensive spearheaded by the extreme right wing against socialism, against progressive governments, against independent governments, and specifically against socialists and even the idea of socialism. And we saw Donald Trump kind of preview that message when he gave a speech in Miami, obviously campaign style speech, gearing up for the 2020 reelection bid. You know, you mentioned Ivan Duque in Colombia, Sebastian Piñera in Chile was also there along the Colombia-Venezuelan border. He's somebody who, you know, his family has deep ties to the former Pinochet military regime. Yeah, and so the idea is that, you know, like John Bolton's Troika of Tyranny says, that there's a couple countries in Latin America. These are countries that, you know, either are socialists or are trying to build socialism. Or have the intention of building socialism. And so they have to be taken out, right, for, as Mike Pence said today, liberty and freedom to reign in the hemisphere. So what we're witnessing is this very dangerous thing that has a super clear ideological overtones to it. And so I think that people, in addition to people in the United States who want to speak out, who are going to, you know, the demonstrations that happened on Saturday against the war. And also there's going to be a national demonstration and a national march on the White House on March 16th, organized by the Answer Coalition. You know, in addition to people going to that who, you know, desire peace, right, who are opposed to this possible devastating new war, people should go there if you think that people like Donald Trump and Ivan Duque and Jair Bolsonaro and all of these other extreme far right wing people shouldn't be the ones determining the destiny of the entire Western Hemisphere.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.